so glad to hear about it.
I beg your pardon? We'll see, probably not, in ways that we don't yet know.
Yeah, I imagine.
I don't see you do, but you can check out the thermostat looking thing over there. Yes, we have a projector, we have a slide, our offer, and a banner.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everybody. Great to see you here. I'm Sue Phillips, and if the flight you're expecting to be on is Congregational Polity and the Myth of Congregational Autonomy, you are headed in the right direction. May I extend a special welcome to all of our friends who are joining by live stream today. This is one of our live streamed workshops, thanks to the miracle of technology. It's especially great to have you. So I want to tell you a story to start with, which is that the first thing I was ever asked to do in a UU congregation is coordinate coffee hour. How many of you, that was your first thing that you ever got asked to do? Now, this is ironic because I don't actually drink coffee, and to this day, I have absolutely no idea how to make it. And thus began the perfect introduction to religious life. Being asked to do something we're not at all sure we really want to do and have no clue how. I think that preaches, don't you?
Amen.
So I showed such promise in my not knowing that the second thing I was asked to do was serve on the ministerial search committee for my congregation's assistant minister. And at our initial meeting, the senior minister explained to this newbie that in Unitarian Universalism, congregations choose their own ministers, and that this combination of responsibility and authority is congregational polity. Congregational what? I asked. I remember with that tone, too, like I was kind of pissed. I didn't know what it meant. Congregational what? Polity, she said, and I thought, oh dear, this definitely sounds more complicated than making coffee. So polity is one of those hardcore geeky religious words we think we should know the definition of, but most of us really only carry around an echo of meaning, a reaction, or some vague historical association. So I want to get this out of the way right at the start. Polity is a doctrine of church, specifically the way churches are connected to one another. And every denomination has a polity. In fact, polity is the only thing that distinguishes a lot of Protestant denominations from one another, which is why so many denominations, like the Presbyterians and Episcopalians and Congregationalists, are actually named after theirs. They're named after their polity, not their theology. So polity is the beliefs and doctrines and structure that hold local churches together with whatever denominational chain of authority or doctrinal accountability exists. But it's obviously also about so much more than that. And to understand what that is, we have to understand something about the values that polity manifests. So there are all sorts of religious practices that can be done alone, but religion, by definition, takes place at the intersection of self, community, and spirit. Now, there's some disagreements about the origin of the word religion, which I did a lot of research about for this presentation, but all of them really relate to how and why people are connected to one another. It's the people connecting that is the common denominator of all these definitions. So spirituality, I would suggest, can be practiced alone. Spirituality can be practiced alone, but by definition, religion can't. And as soon as people come together, as soon as folks come together in some kind of group, we have to work out how we're going to be together. So people become part of communities, which in turn become religious communities, when they share answers to fundamental questions about self, community, and spirit. Questions like, who am I? Who are we? What makes us us? What is the nature of God? What does God want from us? Are humans essentially good or fundamentally sinful? So polity enstructures a community's assumptions about how the world and God and people work. It's the way people choose to organize themselves around their collective purpose. It's the architecture that supports a shared religious life outside of an individual congregation. So polity both creates and reflects purpose. Unitarian Universalists, our cousins in the United Church of Christ, and several other smaller denominations, by the way, across the theological spectrum, are congregational in our polity. I'm sure you've heard that, which means that congregations are both independent and connected to one another in covenant. So in Wikipedia, I'm like a regular person. I looked up congregational polity in Wikipedia. This is what I do with my pleasure time. So in Wikipedia, that tremendous source of, you know, all things true, crowdsourced. Yes, your suspicion is well earned, I can tell, and it's about to be confirmed. Congregational polity is defined in Wikipedia as a collection of self-governed voluntary institutions, which I suppose is at least vaguely accurate, but then the article calls this form of polity a type of religious anarchism. We added that symbol. Mac created these slides, my companion and colleague here. A type of religious anarchism. Now, this is exactly the kind of flair that I love Wikipedia for. But here we have exposed a major challenge of defining congregational polity, that it is so often misunderstood compared usually to other people's polity. So dominant religious culture in the West tends to be more hierarchical, more authority-driven, and more top-down than Unitarian Universalism is. This reflects core theological assumptions, this hierarchy, about human nature and revelation and authority and about who and what God is. So polity with priests and bishops at the center makes sense in sacramental traditions, where intermediaries are required to extend the gifts of God to the people of God, and where adherents are called to participate in specific sacraments as both a practice and a requirement of faith. Traditions believing that Scripture is the infallible, literal word of God will by necessity have strict rules about who can be admitted to fellowship and will concentrate power and authority in the hands of people who adhere to that orthodoxy and correctly interpret the word. This totally makes sense, doesn't it, that polity reflects theology. Traditions believing that humans are stained by original sin or that humans must be saved by a personal relationship to the Savior will have polity that is organized at least partly around naming and correcting sinful behavior. So when our friends at Wikipedia define congregational polity as self-governed voluntary institutions, I think they're defining it in opposition to dominant religious culture, in which a lot of churches are governed by priestly authority and denominational hierarchies, and sometimes, not always obviously, people participate because the safety of their souls depends on it. So while the Wikipedia definition might describe a little piece of congregational polity, it misses a much larger, and I would suggest much juicier, much more fabulous story. So UU congregations, as I'm sure you know, are in fact self-governed. Each congregation names its own conditions for membership, it calls and ordains ministers, and it controls its own budget, among many other things. But we are also explicitly and formally united, at least theoretically, in mutual covenant with other congregations. We intentionally come together to learn together, to support one another, and to accomplish together what we cannot accomplish alone. Things like hymnals and RE curricula and ministerial credentialing and search and settlement. Our congregations may be self-governed, but there is literally no such thing as a Unitarian Universalist congregation which is not connected by covenant to the community of Unitarian Universalist congregations. To be recognized, to be a recognized congregation in our tradition, is to join the Association of Congregations. So our congregations are also voluntary associations in that members and friends participate according to our conscience. No one is compelled by creedal requirement or eschatological fear or priestly mandate to join a UU congregation, at least not that I've heard of yet. But we are collectively, nonetheless, I believe, called to engage in religious community, whether by individual conscience, by justice-seeking community, or by God. Unitarian Universalism teaches that we are called to create beloved community in community. Our theologies may, in fact, do differ about what or who is calling us, but we are united in a belief, aren't we, that we're part of an interdependent web of existence. So this call, wherever it comes from and however it manifests in our individual lives, is that which compels us to come together. There is no such thing, I proclaim, as a Unitarian Universalist by themselves. Our faith is practiced in covenanted community. So I think it's a very bold thing to claim that people cannot really be Unitarian Universalist by themselves. I want to draw a parallel, though, to prove why I think this is true. So in our tradition, congregations ordain ministers, as you know, but only the association can admit ministers into fellowship. Did you know that? So a minister who is ordained but not fellowshipped may call themselves the minister of that specific church, First Parish in Brookline, but they may not call themselves a Unitarian Universalist minister. The individual church claims that minister, but the larger movement does not. So in exactly the same way, I would suggest, a person can claim Unitarian Universalist beliefs, but if they're not a part of a covenanted community, they have not been claimed back, at least not by community. I would never presume to think that those people have not been claimed by spirit. Our faith is practiced in covenanted community. Individual beliefs may constitute spirituality, but they are not religious. They are not, I would suggest, Unitarian Universalist. So participation in our congregations and communities is voluntary in the sense that it's not strictly required by any external authority except for maybe parents to their children on some bad days. But I do think we're responsible, aren't we, to the call to manifest the interdependent web by co-creating beloved community? Does our faith not require us to help increase the sum of love and justice in the world? I believe it's my experience that our faith puts claims on us, moral and ethical, and for some of us, theological duty claims and compels us. We can ignore those claims, but that doesn't mean they're not there. Because we claim and are claimed by our faith, participation in Unitarian Universalist community is so much richer than the notion voluntary participation conveys. Somewhere along the line, I think, our collective understanding of congregational polity became a lot like that Wikipedia definition. It's sort of right, but it's almost exclusively defined in contrast to dominant religious culture and fails to express vital dimensions of meaning that are absolutely core to who we are as UUs. Somewhere along the line, congregational polity became conflated with the autonomy of individual congregations. The rich dimensionality of mutual covenant and interdependence has been sheared off, leaving only the barest bones of isolated self-governance and independence. Congregational polity is a bird grounded with a broken wing. And so, in some ways, I think, is our faith. I think there's a strong parallel between the way we understand congregations' relationship to one another and individual UUs' relationships to their congregations and communities. In just the same way, the independence of individual UUs is often privileged over interdependent community in our congregations. Exploring the conscience and individual journeys of individual people is perceived as the penultimate purpose of many UU communities. So it's natural that our people tend to organize themselves around individual conscience, individual discernment, and direct democracy, rather than mutually covenanted collective conscience, collective discernment, and collective action. To my mind, covenant, mutual covenant, is the missing link in our understanding of congregational polity. Because congregational polity is not the autonomy of individual congregations, but the covenanted communion of autonomous churches. This is, in the words of the great Conrad Wright, a significantly different thing. So I want to repeat that. Congregational polity is, it's literally not the autonomy of individual congregations, but the communion of autonomous churches, a significantly different thing. Believing that congregational polity is primarily concerned with supporting and protecting individual voices and congregations is nothing less than heresy. Yes, I just called it heresy. Believing that congregational polity is primarily concerned with supporting and protecting individual voices and congregations is nothing less than heresy. I'm serious when I call it that. This is not the cute renegade sort of definition of heresy. I mean it in the literal way, like apostasy, the renunciation or abandonment of a religious principle. Because equating congregational polity with autonomy undermines our interconnectedness, it erodes our covenant, and it endangers our communities. It is flat out ahistorical, not to mention wrong. So here's why we should care. I like correctness. I care about historical truthfulness. But the real reason we should care, I think, is that this pervasive misinterpretation of congregational polity with all of this emphasis on individual conscience and direct democracy is a major source of decline and ill health in a lot of Unitarian Universalist congregations. It drives healthy people away. It weakens connections among our churches and beyond. And it perpetuates mind-boggling degrees of suspicion about leaders in general and about our Unitarian Universalist Association in particular, the degree of which can only be described as near psychotic throughout our movement. So there are a few things, I think, in my many years of working with hundreds of congregations, there are very few things more damaging to our congregations than a systemic belief that individual voices, rather than collective purpose, belong at the center of congregational life. Alice Blair Wesley, another just marvelous scholar, avocational, and she calls herself avocational, I call her a genius, in her Mins lectures from 2000 and 2001, they're available on PDF, run, do not walk, marvelous. She decries our collective amnesia about congregational polity, that our interpretation of our tradition pervades so many of our communities and in problematic ways. And I want you to tell me just by amening or raising your hand or murmuring whether you recognize any of these manifestations of this dramatic misinterpretation, this collective amnesia, like endless rethinking of decisions that well-informed leaders have already made. I have a feeling you've been those well-informed leaders. And if you were like me, you are also among those who have questioned those well-informed leaders. What about over-empowerment and even protection of bullying voices? It's easy to laugh out of sheer gallows humor, but devastating, right? Just devastating. Hubristic belief in congregational specialness. A disease we call first parishitis in the Boston metro area. Because about 50 of our congregations are named First Parish. My beloved, so many of you are here. Mwah, I love First Parishes. Also, other characteristics, refusal to consider wisdom from the larger community of congregations, undervaluation of associational connection. These are the sins that are inspired by our collective tolerance for this heresy. I can tell you this is not an exaggeration. Countless people have left our faith. Countless healthy people have left our faith after being turned off, demoralized, or even victimized by these behaviors. And I'm talking about people from at every stage of leadership. The number of congregational presidents who leave their congregations the day after their term ends and never come back literally could make me weep right now. This is such a tragedy. And I believe it's a tragedy because of what I am calling heresy. The only people who want to join communities that deify individual voices are people who want to be deified. Which is why this becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. When we create these communities, the only people who want to be a part of them are people who want to be a part of them. I believe there is another way. Every one of our flourishing congregations and communities knows this way, and perhaps you do too. So I have a group of favorite congregations, which I can't name, because as regional lead in New England, I'm not supposed to have favorites. But I do. Mea culpa. These congregations are so wise. They are so smart and soulful. Everything they do and are is about making love manifest in their time and place. They know in their bones that how they are says everything about who they are and what they care the most about. Somehow they've learned that people of all ages need help to live faithful, growthful lives, and that it is in the congregations, it's the congregation's collective job to be that help. In their written materials, they address this whole spiritual but not religious thing head on in case newcomers are confused. One person alone, they say, is incapable of being a church. So right there, front and center in their founding document, I just love this so much. They know that they are united in covenant with each other so that they can help each other increase the sum of love in the world. These communities don't do membership. They do covenant. And that covenant is so strong that each covenant partner accepts responsibility for reaching out in love to those who wander from that covenant in word or in deed. They do this not because they want to punish each other, but because they genuinely believe, and this is a quote, that no one should ever be cut off from the privileges of the covenant. Their organizing document says explicitly that while officers and ministers can be helpful, they are not absolutely necessary for a congregation to be healthy. Now, I have to admit, there's long sections in there speculating about possible roles for ministers and deacons and pastoral visitors and teachers and treasurers and all that. These are not anarchists, after all, no matter what Wikipedia says. They like a good committee as well as the next. They have a lovely process for being with each other in times of conflict, encouraging people to talk first directly to the people they're having trouble with. You know all this. And if that doesn't work, they ask another person to help them reconcile. If the conflict becomes intractable, this community recognizes that someone might need to leave, since the peace and the well-being of the whole is more important than that of a single individual. But they also promise one another that they won't just leave. They specifically promise that they won't leave fellowship on a whim. They specifically say that being mad at another member is not a good enough reason to leave. They liken people leaving their community to pulling pieces of timber from a building, it's very poetic, or limbs from a whole person. Because folks join the community by entering the covenant, folks can only leave by being released from the covenant. They intentionally and explicitly avoid using the word independent to describe their relationships to other congregations. They celebrate that each church is distinct with special gifts and challenges, and that while churches certainly don't have control over each other, they are nonetheless responsible to one another. And here's my favorite part. These congregations lay out in absolutely delicious detail the ways they will show up for their neighbors. They promise to look out for each other's welfare and consult with them when they need help. They promise to tell hard truths if they see folks acting in ways that are unhealthy. They promise to worship and celebrate together, to share resources, and to work together to extend their faith in the world. I just find this remarkable, don't you? Doesn't it sound like some sort of covenantal promised land? These are communities that understand congregational polity, where independence and covenant alchemize into this precious religious life. So, you want to know where this congregation is? It's here. It's in each of us, in our DNA, as Unitarians and Universalists and Unitarian Universalists, for the congregations whose story I just told came together in Cambridge in 1648. These are our ancestors, yours and mine. They are the authors of the congregational way. Theirs is not a story of independence, not even remotely. The faithful people who gathered in Cambridge in that sweltering summer knew absolutely that they needed one another if they had a chance of serving God. Just a few years before, they had escaped the persecution and oppression of religious and secular authorities, coming to the world specifically to create a new way. My friends, the Cambridge Platform was not a direct declaration of independence. It was a declaration of covenant, of mutual covenant. But somehow, over the last couple hundred years, the vital practices of mutual covenant weakened, both within and outside of our congregations. Our ancestors navigated the American Revolution, the creation of civil democracy, and the separation of church and state, not to mention some intense theological shifts. So over this time, growing diversity and emphasis on individual rights and conscience, the very hallmarks of liberalism that we treasure, many of us, these emerged, I think, to challenge collective accountabilities. I believe these essential elements of liberalism actually eroded covenant's place in the center of our polity for reasons that are compensatory, that we can understand and value. Our ancestors were religious radicals, make no mistake about it. But they were not, as many people believe, theological radicals. Their theology was virtually indistinguishable from the churches they left behind in Europe. They were radical because of their polity, which was based, according to historian Perry Miller, on the pioneer formulation of the principle that a corporate body is created by the consent of its constituent members. This was a totally new idea in 1648, that members of a community could freely gather according to their will and mutual consent, and that together they could make decisions and exercise a stake in the collective mission of the body. Totally revolutionary. But what's also true is that scholars are very quick to warn us that this notion is really different from what we think of as democracy by any modern definition. It wasn't. The community our Cambridge platform ancestors were trying to create was not a direct democracy. Indeed, I think our ancestors would be horrified to learn that their commitment to living by the consent of constituent members would one day lead to such a terrible erosion of covenant, and that independence would overtake mutual reliance. They put covenant at the center because they believed, again in the words of scholar Alice Blair Wesley, that the task of the free church could be summed in their terms, in our ancestors' terms, as loving God and loving one another so well that in their own study and discussion, their dispute and conference, prayer, consultation, and discussion, the members might learn together the divine will of the loving God as it relates to justice and peace and reasonable laws. And if so, the members would be called and compelled and bound, in fact, to proclaim it and try to bring it to bear on their whole society. Is that not what we are also called to do? Is our purpose so different? I don't think so. Our words might be different. Our theological assumptions might be different. Our demography might be different, but I don't believe those fundamentals are different. For anyone who might suppose that our 17th century free church ancestors talked mostly about original sin and predestination and hellfire, Alice Blair Wesley writes, I am glad to be able to tell you that not any one of those topics is ever mentioned in the records of the founding churches. What they wrote about is covenant and being together and practicing being together. That is who they were. Our ancestors organized themselves around loving one another in service to all that is holy. And this, my friends, is the beating heart of congregational polity. So diversity naturally emerges in polities where there is minimal hierarchy and standardization in systems, and that is absolutely true in our case. So we want to talk about congregational polity as expressed in and among our congregations and as being variously located along a continuum with independence on one end and interdependence on another. So this is, this visualization is to help us understand a continuum, but they're not meant really to be polarized opposites. They really aren't opposites. I'm just trying to express your relationship here. So I want to name some examples. We would all agree that congregational polity locates the freedom to determine who can join and how squarely within each congregation, right? That's a fundamental, determining the conditions of membership. But this freedom can be exercised in ways that emphasize either independence or interdependence. In most of our congregations, joining the community happens when people sign the book. Is that true in many of your congregations? Not all, but many. So when people sign the book, it's an individual act of an individual person in a single moment of time. Although a person's sense of connection may well continue to deepen once they sign the book, the act of explicit commitment is over the moment their pen lifts the page. Joining happens only once. So even though they add their name to a long list of other names, there is no one reaching back. Nothing mutual happens in that moment. So on our continuum here, this approach to membership falls way down towards independence. In a few of our congregations, people become part of the community when they formally enter and are welcomed into mutual covenant with the rest of the community. Does this happen in some of your congregations? Yes. In my experience, the most dynamic and vital ones. This covenant that folks are welcomed into calls both the individual and the larger community to specific purpose with specific practices, and the covenant is regularly renewed and reinterpreted. So, both choosing their own path to membership, but this practice of membership falls obviously on the interdependent end of the continuum. So joining and covenanting are different in the way that a wedding is different from a marriage. Both are strictly consistent with congregational polity, but there's no question that a mutual covenanting practice lives more fully into the beautiful potential of beloved community. Amen?
Amen.
So just as religion thrives at the intersection of self, community, and spirit, so too does covenant. It's multidimensional, working horizontally from person to person, but also from that community to individuals and around to the sacred, however we define it. The covenant I've been talking about this morning is not just between people. It's also among communities, which are always greater, in my experience, than the sum of their parts, and with that greater love that surpasses all our understanding. Covenant is both the call and the answer to living a life within all of these dimensions. So I want to explore this idea of covenant just a bit further, because in so many of our congregations, the meaning of covenant has been compressed into the means by which we convey expectations and exercise a degree of control over individual behavior. Behavioral covenants are the only way, not many, most of our congregations experience covenant. Is through behavioral covenants. And there's no mistaking the function, which is to manage unhealthy individual behavior. So we've inadvertently taught our people that covenants are about getting other people to stop behaving badly. Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So this doesn't mean behavioral covenants are bad. It only means that they're not they don't express the fullness of what covenant can be. And we totally come by this honestly. In fact, the Cambridge platform itself is full of stipulations, some of which are hysterical, governing individual behavior. This is my favorite. I have to quote it for you. So it says, attendees at church meetings may not, this is the quote part, oppose or contradict the judgment of the elders without sufficient and weighty cause, because such practices are manifestly contrary unto order and government and inlets of disturbance and tend to confusion. Isn't that so true? Like, a truer thing has never been said. That doesn't mean we would want to have the same stipulation in our covenants, but I just gotta love, they are badass. So anyone who's ever tried to live in religious community knows how important it is to have clear expectations of each other, right? We understand that this is absolutely critical. For our Puritan ancestors, though, the motivation for governing individual behavior wasn't just copacetic community life, but deep awareness that people who practice loving each other are best able to practice loving God. So absent the Cambridge platform's abiding focus on faithful relationship to holiness and grace, the potential depth and breadth of our modern covenants are hobbled to roam the realm of interpersonal relationships, which I believe is a loss. It's a loss that doesn't require theism to feel as a loss. Meanwhile, other congregations and communities use covenant as a way to express their deepest aspirations and values, for this is who we are too. These covenants are engaged liturgically so that worshiping community regularly remembers the greater good to which they are collectively called. The covenants are revisited and reinterpreted, and every time new folks become covenant partners, the entire community recommits to their collective purpose and practices. So I encourage you to consider where on this continuum, the core the continuum, as I referred to it, that's not there. Not your mistake, mine, Mech. I encourage you to consider where on this continuum the core practices of your congregation or community fall, the continuum of independence to interdependence. And if you're willing, challenge yourself to consider what values are being served by practices that land on the independent side of the scale. Because values are surely being served there. Important values, like personal integrity and personal conscience and giving voice to people who may or may not have access to it, and many other values that are important to our communities. The question isn't So values are always being exercised in space. The question is, which are being prioritized, collectively prioritized? That's the question. It's not, is it bad or good to value individual conscience, right? We would never say that individual conscience was unimportant. We might say that practicing creating beloved community might be more important to us, especially in any given moment. That's what this exercise invites you to do. So as Unitarians and Universalists and Unitarian Universalists, we've allowed our beliefs to change over the long years according to conscience and science and revelation. We've managed to stay together even as the core Christian story receded as one of many wisdom stories. Our people have integrated the rationalism of science, the intuition of transcendentalism, and the ethics of humanism. Together, we really have worked theological miracles. Isn't it astonishing when you think about it, how we have done all those things and stayed together? Somehow, we have managed to stay connected as communities of faith through the most radical possible changes to our collective beliefs. I believe that covenant, the collective commitment to and practices of religious community, is how we have stayed together. Covenant is how we have stayed together. And yet, what's true is that we are people of competing commitments. The freedom of belief, which has helped us remain flexible in light of new revelation and experience, also weakens our binding ties. We value interconnection, but we're cautious about asking much of each other. As individuals and groups, we want to belong, but are reluctant to be claimed. This tension between freedom and connection is, I believe, our birthright. But our collective anxiety about this tension, and what I would call a deification of individual conscience, has squashed the rich dimensionality of covenant until it has become synonymous with a vague sense of commitment to a vague sense of principles. We have abstractified covenant into spiritual cohabitation, the big tent under which we eat at separate tables. Covenant lives on as a vestigial metaphor for interconnection in our movement, but that is all. The call to covenant might be a theological imperative, but our collective covenant isn't worth the paper it isn't written on. For there is no such covenant. There is literally no such covenant. As congregations, we covenant to affirm and promote the principles, but this is not a covenant. This way of practicing covenant puts tepid mutual agreement at our collective center. This is not covenanting, this is parallel play. I don't want to disrespect the covenant that we do have or the hard work of countless good-hearted people that went into the language of our principles. They're in the front cover of our gray hymnal. This is not about the principles. It's about the fact that what we have essentially agreed to is not a mutual covenant. It's no wonder that independence is all that remains of our beloved congregational polity. The call to covenant is there at the heart of our faith. It's an echo from our collective past. We sense that interconnection. We preach it. And we certainly rely on it. But covenant is more than impulse and echo. It must be activated intentionally for the full power of liberal religion, I believe, and congregational polity to be revealed. So our people successfully navigated the profound theological shifts of the last 300 years. And I believe that if UUism is to survive even the next century, we must change again. This time by countering forces of individual isolation and institutional disillusion. We must revitalize that which connects us as individuals and religious communities. We must reanimate the mutual covenant as the beating heart of our polity. So in the congregational way, this is the old term for congregational polity, and I think congregational way actually says it better. Autonomy and interconnection cohabitate comfortably. So I don't want to really place autonomy and interconnection on opposite ends of the spectrum, with tensions so taut that pulling a bit in one direction threatens to pull the other off its pedestal. The two are connected by a web, not a rope, and our ancestors knew this. The religious leaders who came together in Cambridge in 1648 arrived there voluntarily. They chose to come together to create a covenanted community of autonomous churches, which is why we desperately need a movement-wide process for re-engaging Unitarian Universalism's collective covenant. Because without continual reaffirmation, the sense of volitional association erodes, and suspicion enters the space where faithful connection should be. So covenant is not coercive, which is why the tendency to assign duplicitous motives to the pull toward interconnection in our system strikes me as being blasphemous. Our covenant makes demands, and these cannot be ignored no matter how loud the voices are resisting the accountabilities that are envisioned in our polity. The problem is that we aren't clear about the demands our covenant places on us, so it's no wonder many of us feel at least a vague sense of resistance. How can we say yes to something, much less do it, if we don't know what we're being asked to do? That feels bad. We can do better. The authors of The Congregational Way were extremely specific about the web of connection they wanted to weave. In the Cambridge platform, the churches promised to take care of one another. Just check out this list, y'all. Take care of one another, consult with one another, admonishing when necessary, which is essentially what I'm doing to all of you this afternoon. They promised to welcome members and new members of their churches, to share ministers, and provide relief and succor in times of need. New congregations promise to offer the right hand of fellowship, recognize that phrase, to existing ones, and large congregations pledge to propagate new ones. We would be very hard-pressed to construct a more relevant list today. These promises are remarkably similar to the ones modern-day UU congregations might make via our associational connection. So this is exactly why the prevalence of often vituperative claims impugning the motives of our UUA is so ironic, because the covenant that our congregations have entered, such as it is, into with each other is, of course, not with the UUA as an institution, it's with each other. Our association only exists because congregations intentionally decided that they need a way to enact their own collective religious vision beyond the unit of individual congregations. The problem is that our UUA, our congregations have come to view, to have their associational connection through the proxy of our UUA. I call that the sort of association by proxy, where our association is expected to bear the full weight of covenantal connection, which is impossible. It's not only is it impractical, it's impossible on an everyday level, it's theologically wrong, and we can do so much better. This is not to say, by the way, that our UUA doesn't have a role to play, simply that as a proxy for the entire denomination's connection to one another, it's weak. So this is part of why our congregations, or the congregations who fail to contribute generously to our UUA, I believe, are out of covenant. The moral problem with this is not that the institution of our UUA suffers, which it surely does, but that those who do not, when we don't provide resources to our UUA, those congregations have turned away from the community of congregations with whom they have covenanted. The only way most congregations connect to other congregations is through our UUA. So this failure means that the next time a sister congregation needs help, they're less likely to receive it. Every time congregations cut back, they're making it less and less likely that there will be somebody on the other end of the phone or to open that front door of the church when their neighbor congregation needs it. Our UUA is often the only way that congregations reach out to one another, and to starve it is to starve associational connection. Until we can do better at connecting people, connecting congregations horizontally and through networks of covenants, that's what we've got. So our polity is a living tradition. It's a pathway for mutually covenanted religious life. Activated by covenant, our polity is more than the simple fact of our connection as individuals, as groups of practicing UUs and congregations. It's also the commitment to connect, the means to connect, the content of the connection, and how we maintain the connection. One shorthand way of saying all that is that covenant is both a noun and a verb, both. Our polity will be revivified when we actually help our people enter and re-enter into covenant with each other and the larger communities of congregations. We might just stop signing the book as a mark of membership in our communities and begin a continual process of discernment that begins and ends with the community and individuals recommitting to one another as an act of faith formation that never ends and must always be replenished as we live and grow together. We might refocus General Assembly's service of the living tradition away from celebrating ministers and toward a ritual recommitment to covenant among Unitarian Universalist people and communities. We might start by creating an actual covenant. So the wise elders who gathered in Cambridge 360 years ago heralded a long practice of coming together to explore our interconnectedness. And while the ways that our people have connected over the years, they varied greatly, actually probably not that greatly, meetings, groups of people traveling to talk to one another for many days in hot places. It really isn't now that I think about it. But the way we meet has become, I think, one of the idols that we have placed at the center of our shared religious life. To my mind, democracy without covenant is governance manifesting the hubris of individual opinion. As a practice, democracy emphasizes the wrong things, namely debate and polarization by design, in which some people win and some lose. When did voting overtake covenanting as the means to our associational end? As a practice, democracy emphasizes the wrong things for a religious community, namely debate and polarization by design in which some win and some lose. When did voting overtake covenanting as the means to our associational end? If we are to live into the full potential of our interdependence, I believe we must put covenant back at the center. Our congregations might move away then from debate and voting-centered annual meetings towards collective discernment about purpose and empowerment of UU ministries in the wider world. So obviously we could go on and on talking about the relationship of democracy to religious community, and I don't want to set up a story that has democracy in somehow being in opposition to religious community. It's a matter of what we emphasize and what's placed at the center of our life. I believe democracy is easier to practice, God help me, than religious community, than trying to create beloved community. Correcting misinterpretation and healing congregational systems from past damage are reasons enough to reinvigorate our collective re-engagement with congregational polity. But I don't even believe these are the best reasons. I believe our stakes could not be higher. Our polity makes us uniquely ready for this emergent spiritual but not religious world, providing handholds for us to move more confidently into that future that we are only learning about. It connects us to our ancestors and gives us practiced means to stay connected to one another, even as those connections take new forms. Our polity helps us to tell our story and transmit our tradition. It's a guy wire for exciting new models of ministry. And it's the connective tissue, I believe, that will bind diverse Unitarian Universalists, ministries, congregations, covenanted communities, and people in the 22nd century. I believe that networks of covenants that cross the individual, congregation, and community lines once and for all will be what connects us as we move into the undiscovered future. Unitarian Universalist ministries living in the beyond of congregations and beyond already know this. Because they are emerging and new, these ministries don't have such strong institutional DNA. The most vital of these beyonders, and I really do mean that the healthiest among them, are trying to create new kinds of communities where membership in the traditional institutional sense is completely irrelevant. But people within these worshiping communities want to feel and be connected. Their leaders are simply asking, how? How can we help our people be connected? And many are answering with covenant, not just internal covenants among participants, but many sincerely want to be in covenant with a larger UU community. The clearest and most prophetic voices in our movement right now are from beyond communities asking to be in mutual covenant with the community of congregations. I literally am having a little trouble holding back tears right now because there is no covenant. There is no covenant for these people to join. Lucy Stone Cooperative and UU Community Cooperatives is such a remarkable example of this. Our friends at Lucy Stone, with whom I have walked for years now, when they did their own collective discernment about whether or not they wanted to be a covenanting community, they were recognized on stage a few days ago, we gladly welcomed them, legitimately wrote back to our UUA board and said, we want to be in mutual covenant. It was the most authentic, beautiful letter I had ever seen, and I realized in that moment, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Folks are extending a hand. The folks who are becoming what we say we want to try to become, and yet, will we extend a hand out? I think we need to, and we need to figure out how. So leaders in emergent UU beyond congregation ministries and so many faithful leaders within congregations are lowering the walls of existing churches and exploring new ways of bringing our ministry, our version of love and justice, out into the communities. There is no roadmap for what we are trying to create together. And yet we are deeply concerned with how to stay in relationship to one another. Our beyond leaders know that community without commitment is no community at all. And so they rightly wonder, as many of us do, about what to ask of participants, what level of commitment to require, and how to engage in mutual covenant. The answers to these questions cannot be told. Nobody knows the answer. They must be discovered. They're discovered together. How are they discovered together? In the process of discerning covenant. The congregational way can help all of us discover the way forward, even in the wide world beyond congregations. And I think this polity is so essential to who we are, precisely because our theology is so broad. Without some kind of vital, clear center around which we convene ourselves, we will not hold. The ways we choose to connect with each other, the ways we choose to connect, is our center. And if UUism is going to survive in the coming time, much less thrive, our center must hold. If we are indeed Unitarian Universalist and not generic religious people, or even worse, generic spiritual people, then by definition, we claim and are claimed by a specific tradition. Ours is not some generic story of democracy or poetic self-reliance or liberal religion. As Unitarian Universalists, we live in a particular stream of history with particular songs and sacred texts and theologies and liturgical practices and justice commitments and ancestors and, yes, polity. In a creedless faith that has grown away from the trunk of our original theological trees, this tradition is absolutely essential. Polity is how our little ragtag band of heretics and liberals, the good kind of heretic, and liberals, communicates across time to tell us who we are and why. It is, in the words of Conrad Wright, part of the consensus that holds the denomination together. There are those who say that identity, especially identity that is mediated by institutions will cease to matter in the coming age. That's not how I read the future. Defining ourselves by one's institutional or personal identities, now that may be dying out, especially among some of our younger generations, and especially among the ones that can afford to untether themselves from their communities of origin. But this is not all of us. But the longing for connection, even those connections transmitted via institutions, that will never pass away. The human longing to be and to stay connected to one another will never pass away. So most people don't make Facebook user an aspect of their identity, but they absolutely rely on Facebook to nurture and energize the connections that make them who they are. Unitarian Universalism can be like that. UU communities connected in covenant via our associational polity can be just like that, providing the architecture for networked connection, no matter how individual people identify themselves. To be a Unitarian Universalist person or congregation is to claim and be claimed by covenant. There is no such thing as a disconnected Unitarian Universalist. To eschew associational connection is to repudiate our polity. Echoing the words of Jewish theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel, we do not make the covenant. The covenant makes us. Our ancestors knew this in their bones. I think it's time you remembered, don't you? Amen. Thank you. Thank you so much for your enthusiasm. Because we're being live streamed, I will at least come out from behind the podium, but I will stay here. Will that work best for the tech crew? Okay. How long do we have? I think we have about 14 minutes, am I right? For your questions and comments, I do ask that I get another drink of water. Just one moment, if you would. And that you use the microphone so that our friends can hear us. So here's what I'm going to ask. If you would ask your question or share an insight in literally just a sentence or two, how you honor that time will free up other people to also participate. So what do you have to say, sir?
Thank you for this. I will be re-listening to it at least twice, maybe three or four times. Two things. How do you see the Orlando platform, how close does it come to modernizing that covenant that we have need to have between us?
So you're referring to the platform that the four southern districts entered into in order to share resources to support the congregations and essentially start becoming the southern region. I must admit that I'm not familiar with the finer points of the specifics of the Orlando platform, but what I do want to say is this is a marvelous example of how to iterate around covenantal connection right now. The whole process of districts morphing into regions, this notion that we started a change that we don't know where it's going to end, to my mind is absolutely made possible because of the flexibilities of our polity. And this is a group of congregations, a large group of congregations, there are about 250 or so, have gotten together to discover and discern for themselves how to support one another. And their answer is this document, which you have shared. And in my judgment, it goes a beautiful long way towards encountering how you will show up and support for one another. So rock on, Southern Region. How many of you are here from the Southern Region? You have a lot to be proud about. Well done, friends.
I just have a question because I couldn't write fast enough. When you started talking about the Cambridge platform, you were speaking of a book and an author. I missed both of those. Could you reiterate?
I believe you're talking about the reference to the historian, Percy Miller? Or Alice Blair Wesley? Was it do you remember what the point was? Maybe I can come at it from that perspective.
I've got in DNA, our ancestors in 1648, Cambridge platform, mutual covenant.
I'll tell you what, if you have a smartphone, check out this QR code. Or go to the tiny URL down here, which is you can put in your browser, and you'll get every single word I said. Won't that be a treat? Yeah. There's a QR reader on the GA app, and literally if you hold it up here and put it in there, up will pop the entire text. And if you forget that, just Google New England Region UUA and go to the resource page. Just Google New England Region UUA and follow the resource page. And if that fails, MEC will help you. Yes.
Hi, I'm Heidi Gould from the Marquette Unitarian Universalist Congregation, 52 members, huge. And what I want to say is I almost went to another workshop yesterday, but I attended yours. The other one I wanted to go to was on outreach. But it was overflowing because we all want to grow. We all want more people to come to our congregation. But I decided to come here. And what I've really, truly realized how poignant and important this is, I've been thinking a lot about covenant all of this year so far. And because creating that covenant is going to be what creates the strong foundation that we want to attract people into that will help strengthen and retain new members. You know, it's going to what... be what embraces them and helps keep them.
Can we get an amen?
My question is, you keep saying kind of, you know, that we're starting from scratch in the way of covenant, and yet you also mentioned, you know, not utilizing UUA resources. And there is that PDF on vision, mission, and covenant. And I'm wondering if that's not good enough or if it's a good place to at least start.
This is another document that I don't have intimate familiarity with, but I believe there are many resources out there that can be helpful. These are not really new ideas that I'm having, but what I do want to acknowledge is that the resources that exist tend toward using covenant as, in terms of behavioral covenants, and aren't as robust around actual mutual covenanting. That said, a number of congregations do this very well. The first that comes to mind is Rochester. What's the full name? First Unitarian in Rochester. But part of the reason that it's good to talk amongst ourselves about this is that there is a lot of wisdom in our congregations about what works in terms of covenants, and we need to surface, get that wisdom risen up so we can share it better. So the best I can say is, like, so Marquette, it's Marquette, right? Could you please figure this out? And, like, just share what you learn with us. Just practice, experiment something, and then let the rest of us know, and we'll keep iterating. Hi.
Hi. Do you want us to say our names?
Why don't you? I think it's fun to find out where people are from.
I'm Bill Sasso. I'm from the Carbondale Unitarian Fellowship in Southern Illinois, and a former student minister at the Marquette congregation in the 1990s, long ago. I was intrigued by your spectrum which shows the endpoints kind of a naive or shallow understanding of polity versus a more in-depth understanding of it, and wondered if the comments you were making about democracy might also where you were talking about democracy being not the most helpful thing in religious community, I'm not quite sure how to characterize them, but making it more difficult, something like that. And I'm wondering if you were talking about, again, a shallow understanding of democracy versus a more nuanced one. And the particular thing that makes me ask that question is that at one point you talked about, at least the way I remember it, you talked about collective discernment and action as an element of the more nuanced, deeper form of covenant. And I actually wrote that down thinking about that's how I understand democracy to be realized, collective discernment and action. And I'm curious to your thoughts in response to that.
I cannot speak eloquently on different forms of governance. Clearly, democracy is a time-tested way for groups of many sizes to exercise collective discernment and collective action. I know many communities choose other models of making decisions, like the consensus model, et cetera, and I'm certainly not a proponent of, can you imagine General Assembly by consensus? It practically gives me a heart attack to contemplate. I think you gave me the appropriate out, and this is the truth, that the way we practice matters very much. But it's also, you know, when the decision-making is yes or no, you have to create questions that have answers, yes or no. And the truth is, most religious questions don't have answers that are yes or no. They have answers that are like, kind of, maybe, if this, what if, how about, can I imagine? And that's really the mismatch. Do I know the answer? I don't, but I do have my suspicions that there are other ways to engage one another, or that we need to change the kind of questions we bring to democracy and have other processes. As we see practiced at General Assembly, there's more decision-making happening than just by direct democracy. Yeah, but it's a very good question. Yeah.
I'm here to read two questions from two of our off-site participants.
Oh, great.
Ann Burns asks, are there tools available for covenantal discernment, discovery, and writing?
It depends on what kind of covenant you're talking about. There are actually a large number of resources available on our UUA website about writing covenants. The question is, what kind of covenant are you going to find? What kind of covenant is that writing going to create? And the truth is, I didn't look for resources that really would fall into the, oh, I should be talking here, that express the fullness of the kind of covenants I've been talking about. So what I can promise to do is do some looking and to try to post a resource on the same URL that is posted here. Give me a couple of weeks and I'll see what I can find to kind of curate some resources for you.
Stacy from online asks, how can we, who advocate for covenant, help break through mindsets that focus on qualifications and requirements?
Become a theologian and offer workshops. It's easier than enacting. Okay, you know what, really? I don't want to make this sound simple because it's not, but I would say that values are what motivate people to change. And so grounding a sense of covenant in history, in theology, in morality, and connecting it to values is the key. Because if it's about strategy, that's not a good entree into uncovering and celebrating the gifts of covenant. I would really try to talk about values and theology. But of course, some congregations are more tolerant of conversations that happen at that level than others. So that's the quickest answer I can offer. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Marianne Boy, and I'm from Woodbury in the Mattituck Unitarian Universalist Society.
One of my home congregations, thank you.
So I just want to tell you to have faith. We are in year four of working our covenant. It took a year to write it from the congregation very mindfully. It was written to be rewritten anytime the congregation wanted. Now, yes, it was behavioral in nature, but guess what happened? It is changing to becoming more the other way, because we realized how I am with you is more important than any task at hand. And guess what? That changes all the conversations. So have faith and, you know, think about it and work it, because we're in year four.
Awesome testimony. Thank you.
My name is Bob Lovell. I'm from the UU Church of Greater Lansing. Just a comment, really. If you're a GA, it's pretty easy to confuse democracy with Robert's Rules of Order. They are not the same thing. Robert's Rules of Order are a terrific source of oppression if you want to use them that way. A deep knowledge of Roberts can allow you to control a meeting in ways that it ought not be controlled. Our congregation has simplified it a little for congregational meeting into what we just casually call Bob's Rules of Order, but a lot simpler than Robert's. And it's a way to think about this thing, a way to covenant within the meeting.
Did you say your name was Bob? Uh-huh. Oh, I'm sure. No, just kidding. But thank you for adding some complexity. Yeah, no, seriously, thank you for that. Hi, Bruce.
Bruce Taylor, First Parish Church in Billerica. At a certain point in your presentation, I heard a distinction between the association and a covenant. I've often thought that our association would be where a covenant would reside that would connect all of our churches. You mentioned how some people use the UUA as a proxy for a covenant, and when that doesn't work, they turn away from it. Would you be advocating that the UUA develop something more like a complete covenant? Clearly, we have some covenantal language in there, but are you hoping to develop something like a Cambridge platform that would apply to all of our churches?
Why, now that you mention it. So our association isn't the headquarters staff. Our association, as we all know, is the community of congregations. And so when I'm talking about our UUA creating a covenant, I'm talking about us creating a covenant together. And I would love to see some new version of the Cambridge platform. I see us as having a network of covenants. That is my vision, is a core covenant into which people can partner, communities can partner, congregations can partner, that perhaps has different iterations that are locally or regionally or districtly activated and nuanced so that we can retain that special local character of so many of our congregations. But yes, I do believe there is a role for our association. In fact, we heard Jim Key in his moderator's report name covenant as a major priority for our UUA board in the coming year. And I believe this is what he's talking about. Stay tuned. So we have time for just a couple more, which is great. There's two more people in line.
Okay, I've only been a UU for about 3.5 years, and in that time I've been on committees and am now on the Board of Trustees already, but one thing I find sterile in UUs is that Robert's Rules of Order, thumbs up, thumbs down, if there's 5 thumbs up and 4 down, discussion's over. I come from a tradition that is the ultimate in patriarchal and hierarchical, but at the local level, decisions were made through prayer and discernment. There might be a ballot to begin with just to see where we stand, like in the movie 12 Angry Men. But then the discussion, that's where the discussion begins. It's not where it ends. And I'd like to see that again.
What do you think, people? Yeah. Thank you.
A question from online, our offsite folks. Amy Webb asks, can you provide any sources for alternate paths to membership models?
Oh, yes. Okay, now you're going to ask me to name specific congregations, which I cannot do. Did you say Amy Webb? Amy, check out this URL again in a week or two if I could trouble you to do that, and I'll try to put some resources together with my UUA colleagues. So stay tuned. I know there are some excellent examples out there. So, friends, you have managed the impossible. You have stayed awake. At least some of you. I did notice a few people not off. I can't blame you. So thank you so much for your leadership, but also for caring about congregational polity so much to come and add your good heart and mind to these great questions. Thank you so much for coming. So you know what I can? I don't actually know it.
I was a tech usher. So I just wanted to know that, just let you know that we're excited about your talk. And one of the comments that came.
Was there chat?
Oh, that's a chat.
Oh,
yeah, you know. No, I got to let you see the chat. So if you get a second, you can come over and look at it. But one of the things that came out, they thought you should, so I said I wouldn't relate this to you, is that they think you should write an article about this in the world with all this stuff because you know, they thought it was very impressive. So. File material, 1% size. I have six. I gave them your email so they could talk to you directly.
Oh, great.
Because they wanted to get the slides and everything and your text. You provided that, so. But then I also told them they could help you. Amy, especially.
Tell them to write Chris Walton.
Oh, Chris Walton. Okay.
No, I'm just giving them a shout out. But I would love to ask you that.
Sure.
About a week ago.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I bet it does.
I don't think we need a remote thing, but I've got one for you.
Well, not with it here. We'll have to
stand
here.
Right there.
Only from us. So nothing in. I do too. But they told me they had to reform it in some way.
So that's they have to make it a PDF.
Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
I think it's only format due. They just show it as a PDF. Yeah.
I think I'll have a chance to call you.
Okay. I'm trying to think of if we mentioned in this presentation. Yeah, were you in the last session with me? Because he did talk a little bit about when people actually pledge. Right. Yeah. No, I know. It's all over the map.
20% more brightness out of that thing.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
But let me see. It's fine. It's fine. I just thought we'd have.